ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। रीडिंग फ्रॉम कैंटो 7 श्रीमद् भागवतम चैप्टर 5 टेक्स्ट 55। अथ तान् श्लक्ष्णया वाच प्रत्याहुह महाबुध उवाच विद्वांस्तन्निष्ठाम् कृपया प्रहसन् इव। Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Ex Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Prahlad Maharaj, who was truly the supreme learned person, then addressed his class friends in very sweet language. Smiling, he began to teach them about the uselessness of the materialistic way of life. Being very kind to them, he instructed them as follows. Purport. Prahlad Maharaj is smiling is very significant. The other students were very much advanced in enjoying materialistic life through religion, economic development and sense gratification. But Prahlad Maharaj laughed at them, knowing that this was not the actual happiness, for real happiness is advancement in Krishna consciousness. The duty of those who follow in the footsteps of Prahlad Maharaj is to teach the entire world how to be Krishna conscious and thus be really happy. Materialistic persons take to so-called religion to get some blessings so that they can improve their economic position and enjoy the material world through sense gratification. But devotees like Prahlad Maharaj laugh at how foolish they are to be busy in a temporary life without knowledge of the soul's transmigration from one body to another. Materialistic persons are engaged in striving for temporary benefits, whereas persons advanced in spiritual knowledge, such as Prahlad Maharaj, are not interested in the materialistic way of life. Instead, they want to be elevated to an eternal life of knowledge and bliss. Therefore, as Krishna is always compassionate to the fallen souls, his servants, the devotees of Lord Krishna, are also interested in educating the entire populace in Krishna consciousness. The mistake of materialistic life is understood by devotees and therefore they smile upon it, considering it insignificant. Out of compassion, however, such devotees preach the gospel of Bhagavad Gita all over the world. So here, Prahlad Maharaj's position is gradually now being seen as a guru. He is only 5 years old, he's playing with his friends, but in this whole process we can see the transformation that is taking place, not in him, it's only the visible aspect that we are now seeing, that when he is beginning to speak to his friends and he's just about to embark on the explanation on the uselessness of materialistic life. And so here Prabhupada comments that the Prahlad Maharaj is smiling. This smiling is not out of any superiority complex or feeling that we are out of condescension. It is actually out of great compassion and also understanding that we don't get carried away by the externalities. And this is a lesson for us, because even as we come to the temple, we are aspiring to be devotees, but often, at least in our initial stages particularly, we do get carried away by or pulled both ways. We start getting convinced about the philosophy and the understanding of the mentally on what the spiritual life is about, that we're not this body, but we're not able to consciously and subconsciously practice it every moment of our life. So at times when we are through our occupation or when we're in contact with the external world, we do see people who are blessed with tremendous attributes, tremendous by our standards, by the world standards. Of course, if we see from the eyes of the Shastra, these are very puny compared to the attributes we have seen literally right through the pages of all the scriptures. But nevertheless, because of our conditioning, we do get carried away. So this is the time when we can understand from Prahlad Maharaj's viewpoint, which is representing really what a guru teaches, not just by word, but by full understanding, that we see everything, all the attributes is coming from the Lord. And therefore, we appreciate if somebody is very powerful, very strong, or blessed with a very sharp intellect, we can see, we can appreciate that. We shouldn't be envious, but we see who's ultimately the creator and how the every person is just an individual. So really, Prahlad Maharaj, by his instructions to his friends, saying that really a human being is really one or only when he actually starts taking instructions from his spiritual master, from others in the way of life. Only then we say that we are fulfilling the path of, means we are actually on our way to being a human being. And again here, there are many examples we can think of where, how devotees or people approach in the right mood to seek a spiritual master. Sanatan Goswami was one of the six Goswamis. Of course, he's a pure devotee, but he teaches us again by his example and words. When he approached Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was a great scholar, very learned. So he was telling Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that, everybody in my neighborhood is calling me a great scholar, but I'm very ashamed and I feel very, I'm not happy about it. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked him why. So he said, because actually they call me a pandit, but I don't even know what is my goal in life. I don't know what I should be doing. So how can I be called a pandit? Of course, he went on to say that I'm simply being carried away by sense gratification. But that was his mood, that he was extremely humble. But he also showed that he, approaching a spiritual master is not for, say, some material objects or gold or medicine or some benefits. It is basically, it is enlightened self-interest, understanding that such a personality, we can evoke his mercy if we genuinely open our hearts and minds to such a person. Also, a very wonderful example of when Lord Krishna came in the incarnation of Lord Kapila as the son of Devahuti. So Devahuti is actually the mother, but she is actually telling Lord Kapila that you are my son, but actually you are my guru, because through you, you will be able to help me to cross over the, inform me how I can cross over this ocean of nations. So this is the mood which a living entity needs to understand. And also Prabhupada says repeatedly that actually the goal of human life really ultimately is to seek a spiritual master and to through him to try to attain the lotus feet of the Lord. This is the overall and the ultimate purpose. Everything else is subordinate to that. So we would have various activities, but they all need to dovetail towards that. So basically our only business really is the final and the most important and the main business is to accept a spiritual master. Again, the example of Arjun, when he approached, again he was a perfect devotee, but for the benefit of mankind, in Bhagavad Gita, when he, right in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, he speaks to Krishna and says that, you know, I'm completely bewildered, I'm confused, I don't know what to do, please instruct me. He says, I'm totally overcome by weakness and I cannot think. So, and then he says that I'm a soul surrendered unto you. So that is very significant that ultimately when we seek a spiritual master, we surrender to him. So, against this backdrop, when we look at our own life, the starting point would be to seeing that how the various perplexities of life are not in our control. And also, they come without our desire. These perplexities, they come, it's not that we actually desire problems. Nobody has that desire. We are desiring happiness, but problems come. So, living entity starts understanding that these difficulties are going to come. We have our quota, which we'll have to accept. And they are like a forest fire, which suddenly start getting ablaze without knowing who actually starts it. It just happens. It's automatic. And without any apparent cause. And again, we see so many examples. You can see practically daily events happening which are having such impact all over the world. Recently, in the last 2-3 weeks itself, a couple of weeks ago in Burma, for instance, a cyclone of such a magnitude that they say over 150,000 people have perished, and perhaps if they don't reach aid very soon, some estimates say that even 10 times that amount, means up to 15 lakh people could die if the world aid is not allowed to reach them. But I mean, within seconds you can say how in the helplessness of individuals and collectively as a nation or as mankind we have no control over things. And last week, just a few days ago in China also, there was a massive earthquake. It's supposed to be one of the very advanced countries. But yet, just in a matter of seconds, a complete destruction. And in China is notorious for either not giving any information or understating, because that is the way they control information, being a communist country and a dictatorship. They always say only something which either they will try to stifle information, there is no free press, or if they have to inform, then they reluctantly do it, and that too, they minimize it. And yet, by their official count, they are saying 50,000 people have died and 103,000 injured. So one can take this with a pinch of salt and see the magnitude. And again, these are numbers. You know, when you open the newspaper and you see headlines of such magnitude, we cannot actually imagine the kind of devastation, and not only the physical, but emotional, and to millions more who are affected. We see in our own example, if someone close to us is affected, you know, either badly injured or leaves his or her body, you know, it is we take such a long time to recover. What to speak of when this happens on such a magnitude, and that too, we've just talked of two, but these happen, and there are many man-made also, for instance, when terrorism strikes, people die. So we can see that the helplessness of a living entity is because the perplexities are not going to be controlled. And no matter what we do, no matter how we try to justify it or try to say that this, it will never change. And in fact, the world admits that actually this is increasing rather than decreasing. So this is really the wrath of the Lord. And in China, for instance, one interesting fact that you know, this is where we compare it with the Hiranyakashipu model of economic development. Of course, he had refined it to a much greater extent. You know, he had perfected it to such an extent that he was very successful. So by that standard, it is not even worth comparing because whatever models we see. But nevertheless, the motivations were same, highly atheistic, highly antagonistic to the Lord. So just like Hiranyakashipu wanted to have full control, in China also, everybody considers it to be the model growth for the last 20 years. And they seem to have, on one hand, they can force people to do what they want. And on the other hand, they give them the material luxuries and the temptations of an improved standard of life. So people get motivated for that. And in the process, they defined, one of their so-called problems was population. Because everybody all over the world says that China and India have a big population. So in China, their major weapon against overpopulation was that some 25 years ago, they made it mandatory for families to have only one child. It's compulsory. And because they are a dictatorship, they can enforce it. You cannot have more than one child. And when this devastation took place, several schools, you know, thousands of children have been killed. Now you can imagine what it does to a parent. You know, there are several parents here. You can just imagine what it would be, especially if you have only one child. Suddenly, whether you have whatever bank balance, success, everything, the whole world for them will seem, because they have not any knowledge. They don't have the see for the eyes of the Shastra. So here we can be very fortunate to understand that we will also have suffering. We do have, and we will continue to have, but then when we see our good fortune of at least getting an understanding of where it is coming from, then it gives us an ability to sustain and to be able to absorb it, to understand it, and perhaps also overcome it with the help of the association of devotees and the process of devotional service. So when you approach a spiritual master, the spiritual master has every right also to chastise us, to correct us, because otherwise, how do we improve? How can we go forward? So in Arjuna's case, for instance, when he approached the Lord, saying that, I'm confused and he was lamenting this way. So Krishna actually tells him that, you know, you speak like a learned person, but then these are not the words of a learned person. A wise man does not lament either for the living or the dead. So it was a chastisement really, but because Arjuna was receptive and he accepted that. But then you have the case of Ramchandra Puri, who was Madhvendra Puri's disciple. And he typifies a devotee who, a disciple who has arrogance and considers himself very advanced, because that is also something which is a great threat to our progress, because we do over time tend to feel that we know and we have understood the process, because we keep hearing perfection. We hear the Shastras, we see the perfect process, we also see very special devotees around us in the world, and therefore there is over time, if we don't check ourselves, we start seeing that perfection in ourselves. And then over time, like Ramchandra Puri, think that even our spiritual master needs correction. So when Madhvendra Puri was actually in his last days, and he was lying there in his old age, and he was actually crying out because he was in great separation, transcendental separation. So Ramchandra Puri, because he was in such a envious and arrogant state, so he was actually, he had the audacity to chastise his spiritual master and say that, you know, you are supposed to be very learned and you are supposed to be seeing from a transcendental position and to be on the Brahman platform, so why are you crying? And then he incurred the wrath of Madhvendra Puri, who got very angry, and he said, you know, you are a rascal and you get out. So we could have two kinds of chastisements. If we approach in a humble way, we will get appropriate chastisement, but we will also be then grateful for it and improve. And then we would also have the other type. When, either by word or by deed, or Krishna will take care, because certainly it is an offense. So today, the second type, when you're seeking gurus for our own selfish purposes, and Prabhupada says this here in the purport, materialistic persons take to so-called religion to get some blessings so that they can improve their economic position and enjoy the material world through sense gratification. This is a statement which really, again, reflects on, let's say, almost everybody in the world who considers themselves believers. Very, very few would really accept that taking to spiritual life means not at all seeking material gains. And then material gains would be incidental. Whatever is in our quota, we work hard, and if whatever is there, we will get. What is not there, whatever we do, we will not get. But then the danger is that we will, when we see around us, successful people in all walks of life, they will have, because it is really as if the institution of guru or having a person who externally to the world is seen as a someone who is seemingly in an spiritual authority actually suits our position also, because it gives us an impression. People see and say, okay, you know, see such a humble person, you know, he touches someone's feet, he puts someone's photo on the wall, on and off he would come on the stage with that person, talk to him. So these may be gestures, but a real understanding of seeking a spiritual master is to see from the eyes of the Shastra, the Guru Sadhu Shastra triangle, which conforms when both the Guru is speaking is identical to the previous Acharyas and is identical to the Shastras. And we select the person, and then instead of our having any ideas or having crooked thoughts of using him in our service, we should actually be giving ourselves to the service of how he can use us in Krishna's service. So that should be the mood. And today is actually also a very, very, very auspicious day. It is the disappearance day of Jayananda Prabhu. And it is also because Jayananda Prabhu's example actually is really of the most ideal disciple. So when we talk of spiritual master and disciple, it would be worth seeing his life. And also because Jayananda Prabhu lived in our generation, practically. He was a disciple of Srila Prabhupada. And it would be, he was the first devotee in the ISKCON movement, the very first. So it's a historical fact, whose disappearance day is officially celebrated all over the world, and who was Srila Prabhupada's disciple. So Jayananda Prabhu was very simple, very, very simple, right from childhood. Some years ago, one devotee from Vrindavan, Bhakti Siddhanta Prabhu, he's a painter, he was in Delhi, and he met this one Sardarji, who, after they got to talking, and then just see the amazing events, because he came from the Sardarji, was because he saw that this is a devotee, ISKCON, and so he started talking, and he said, I was in the US, and then finally it came out that he was actually studying and then staying in the same room as Jayananda Prabhu. So he also confirmed that there was a very, even at that time in the youth, he wouldn't get carried away, because it was typical for students to just, you know, go out for drinks, partying, etc., just let their hair loose, as they say. He was very, very sober, very serious. Even at that time, he was very much interested in self-realization topics and also welfare work. He was a very kind-hearted person. So that was a confirmation from them, from a person who had no connection to ISKCON. And his first contact with Srila Prabhupada was very, very early on, before even Prabhupada had even established ISKCON. When Srila Prabhupada went to the West, he stayed a very short time in Pennsylvania, Butler, Pennsylvania. Then he came to New York. And the very first thing in New York he had the contact was Dr. Mishra's yoga retreat. So Jayanand Prabhu, his name was Harvey at that time. So he used to go there for yoga lessons to Dr. Mishra's retreat. And he noticed this old saintly person in an orange shawl sitting in the corner. He was just chanting to himself and not really getting mixed with the main crowd which was coming regularly. So mostly old ladies who used to come there. Rich old ladies. So after some time, few days, when he noticed that he actually, because he also was not fitting in really, in his heart, this Harvey. So he approached Srila Prabhupada and he asked him, okay, you know, what are you doing here? Why have you come here? And Prabhupada mentioned his connection with Dr. Mishra. And then he asked him, I said, what are you doing here? So he said, I have come to study Hatha Yoga. And then Prabhupada told him that he hardly knew him that time, but he said that this is not the purpose of life. So that statement went very deeply into Jayanand Prabhu's heart, because perhaps he anyway sensed it. And when he saw this person who could honestly speak to him, and someone, so immediately his appreciation, respect went up. So when Prabhupada came back to New York, then he started visiting Prabhupada, and by that time he acquired the 26 Second Avenue matchless gift shop. So he would go there, meet him. But also, Jayanand Prabhu originally came from San Francisco, and his parents were staying there. And you know, he had some money with him. So that time, this was the time of the hippies who just thrived on, you know, renouncing everything, but at the same time just bumming around, but picking on, I mean, those who had some money would go to them, take something or the other. So people were harassing him for, you know, all the time because he had a little money. So he went back to San Francisco. And then when Srila Prabhupada went to San Francisco for the first time, which was very early in 67, hardly a few months after he established ISKCON, and Prabhupada landed in, at that time they all called him Swamiji. So he had never spoken to anyone in San Francisco, didn't know anybody there, except Mukund Maharaj, who was the first disciple to help him establish 26 Second Avenue. And then he had flown to San Francisco. So when Prabhupada went there, Prabhupada was astonished that he had not spoken a word to anyone, and still there were more than 100 hippies in their various colorful, fanciful garbs, you know, waiting at the airport to receive him. So he was very pleasantly surprised. And then as soon as he got in the car, he asked, he said, where's Harvey? Because he remembered that Harvey was a very sincere person in New York and he had moved to San Francisco. And then the person who was driving the car just turned around and said, Swamiji, here I am. He said, welcome to San Francisco. And then he said, because it happened that he was the only person who had a car. He was the only person who actually had any economic sustenance, means a job. So he, Jayanand Prabhu was sustaining the temple single-handedly at that time. And he was very, his nature and character was quite amazing, because he was very, very kind, very large-hearted, very genuine person. And his whole mood was only how he could serve devotees. So even before Prabhupada came, whatever little they had started to contribute towards the temple, the first temple that they had got in time for Prabhupada to come there, basically he was the only person, because everybody else was just kind of, you know, in their words, spaced out and not doing anything really. So he was driving a taxi primarily for giving his contribution to the temple. And then when Prabhupada actually came to know that, so then he told all the devotees. By that time, even Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and he had also just joined in the San Francisco temple. So he told them that you start going for Sankirtan. So then the Sankirtan started. They would go out in the streets chanting and distributing leaflets, incense and whatever paraphernalia. And then they started. That became also a source of income. And afterwards then Jayanand Prabhu quit driving, because then there was some stability which had come. He was the first temple president of the San Francisco temple. He was one of the more reluctant presidents. Really, his mood was not there, but because he was liked by all and he had boundless energy, so they asked him to. One thing about him was that any person who came in his contact, anyone, whether it was the very tough guys in the vegetable and fruit market, they had they have a very famous area called Fisherman's Wharf. And there you have a lot of these, many people that, at least at that time, were connected to the Italian mafia. Strong guys and, big guys, and many were fruit vendors and so on. But all of them loved Jayanand Prabhu. And the devotees also loved him. So, it was like Dhira, Dhira, Jano, Priya, Karo. That the Shad Goswami Ashtakam tells us, he was loved by everybody who came in contact. And he always carried a cookie jar with him, so that he could distribute cookies to all, whoever came to him. So everybody would know him as, where's this guy with the cookies? That was those who knew, didn't know his name, they would call him Jay, for Jayanand, because in the U.S., anything beyond three or four letters is just, it's very difficult for them to understand. So either Jay or where's the guy with the cookie bars. But everybody loved him. And that he used in helping ISKCON in the temple. Because he any service he did, contributions, people were happy to give him, very happy to give him. One person once gave him 1 ton of apricots. So anything he would never refuse. He would just go and take, and he would then help the temple. Then they made got the whole temple, and anybody who was walking on the street, they got him to help make apricot chutney, which lasted them a pretty long time. He also was always very inventive. He was, there in the U.S., they're very particular about the food and health. They have a food and health administration department, which mandates it that there is an expiry date for all produce and the ones which are perishable, and then they have to be compulsorily removed from the shelves. It is illegal to keep any produce, any especially dairy products. They have to be removed from the shelves after the expiry date. But not that the material is always bad. Oftentimes it's good enough, but it is passed out. So they have to. So generally, all of them would then sell, give it away to for free. To the pig farmers. So Jayanand Prabhu would don overalls and go as a pig farmer. And then he would talk in the language, say, I've got a big farm, and so he got any returns, and whatever it is, he would collect. So he had no kind of ego. He would do any kind of service. And though he was a temple president, it was very common to see him that he was the first and the most energetic to clean the temple floors. He was the main person getting all the garbage out. Since he knew, he was the only one who had a car, driving a taxi, so he knew everything about cars. So anybody walked in, he would be fixing the cars. So usually he's always covered in grease. So while he was a president, and even later when he was not, his service was just to help everyone. And he really thrived in getting newcomers. And because newcomers just... first of all, when they come to the temple and they want to walk in, they're curious, they're just walking past, and then they would find him under the car or maybe nearby, hovering around, taking the garbage out. So he would be usually among the earliest ones they would first talk to. And the minute you talk to him, he'd be so friendly and so nice that you immediately get attracted to him. And then it was very common those days that the people would come in by the hundreds or thousands, and then many would leave after some time. Because it was so revolutionary. It is even revolutionary now, but 37 years ago, you can imagine, 40 years ago, it was, especially in the U.S., seeing shaven-headed and Shikha and things. So people, not many could really sustain to stay there. But anyway, even if they came, he would engage them in service, get them to, and put his arm around them, talk nicely, and say, can you do this, can you do that? And then find out what their talent is, and then get them to do it. And then they would leave, and then somebody else would come. Again, he has to go and train them. So that was one of his major services, and something which he was really very good at. But his eternal service really was the he was known as Mr. Rath Yatra. Eventually, many devotees then and even now called him, because he was really if you have to associate in word association, it's a Jayanand Prabhu Rath Yatra would be very common. So he was really instrumental in actually getting the Rath Yatra off the ground and established in San Francisco to start with, and then later on in New York, and then even in Los Angeles. So in 1967, we have also heard from Shyam Sundar Prabhu, who was also very closely associated little later with Jayanand Prabhu on the Rath Yatra making. But if there was one person who was instrumental in getting everything done, for instance, you just get a place nearby, unused parking lot or whatever, and then start getting things done, and finding all the talents of various people. Somebody, devotees would engage in carpentry, making these gigantic rath, and especially the very first one in San Francisco. So it took days, and eventually, as people saw that this Rath Yatra was a yearly phenomenon and a major activity. And it was quite common. People say that last three or four days, when they compared notes, nobody ever saw him sleep. Because he was always engaged in getting devotees to do some service, or new devotees walk in, newcomers are walked in, get them to do that, working round the clock. He was... much later, when he just after he had left this world, this is the an example of how much he was loved by everyone. People who just got attracted to him and remembered him so strongly. So after he left this world, next year when the devotees went to the city administration, the mayor's office. See, one of the key aspects of getting the Rath Yatra off the ground, especially in those days, which was so novel, was to get all the permissions, to first convince the administration's officials. They never heard of what Rath Yatra is, and seeing the forms of Jagannath, Baldev, Subhadraji, and the cart, and this whole concept was, he was the key person to would go there and sweet talk and cajole and convince everybody that, you know, what it is. So by that time, since he had to do it every year, you know, everybody just knew him and they loved him. So for the 9 or 10 years he was there, till his departure in May 1976. He was just the most important person in a way, because everybody individually looked forward to him, and especially getting the cookies from him. So the year after he left, when they went to the city administration, this lady who was a very, very senior person in the administration next to the mayor, and there the mayor is a very powerful person. In fact, he's really like, you know, what we have a mayor come municipal commissioner. The powers the mayor has, very powerful. So so she said, hey, where's this guy with the, where's Jay? I'm missing his cookies, not come. So when the devotees told her that, you know, he's now no more. And here was this lady who's not at all a devotee, very aggressive, very competent, very so-called in charge of everything that she does, has been coming up the ranks, and when she heard this, she just broke down, started sobbing completely uncontrollably, just couldn't help. That was a spontaneous reaction, just because she knew that this person was such a valuable person, and imagine how much respect everybody could get, everybody had for ISKCON, just because of his example, by the thousands. San Francisco, he was one of the most popular persons, and everybody knew him. Later on, he also joined the Radha Damodar Sankirtan Party. And though he, that was for a short time, but he was also, his main idea was what way I can help Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, the services he did, nobody would have ever thought also that, oh, he's not into book distribution, because he was doing so many things. Yet he knew that Srila Prabhupada was so keen on distributing his books, and that especially when the new books had started coming. So once he went to the bank and he got all his savings, he had about $5,000, so he took out everything and gave it to Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada printed the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And after that, he saw that the books had come and they were all lying there. So he got personally involved in the distribution of the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Now, as we know, the teachings of Lord Chaitanya is not exactly the most marketable product, and that too in 1968-69, and that too in San Francisco. So he would go, not only in San Francisco, every bookstore. He went to, took his car and went to nearby cities. And very often, many devotees have spoken this. We've heard Deen Bandhu Prabhu, then Shyam Sundar Prabhu. This point has been brought out that sometimes you distribute just two or three books in a day after spending 10-12 hours. But his enthusiasm was enormous. So he would do anything he could just because he knew that Prabhupada wanted that. And of course, he loved prasad. Everybody also who knew him would say that he used to eat huge quantities. But he was a very strong, well-built, tall guy, extremely affable personality, very, very pleasing. But you know, he could obviously absorb it because he used to work like three or four men. And his theory was when he used to be fall sick, he would eat even more. So when one devotee asked him, he said, "How come you should be starving?" He said, "No, because actually when you're sick, then you have more germs. So you know they can get more mercy. So if you eat more prasad," and he was so serious. That was his mood, you know. He said, that because there are more germs, so we should eat more, so then they will get benefit. One of the very wonderful stories about his prasad pastimes is that he was in that time in San Francisco, and that time the temple president was a devotee called Keshav Prabhu. And nearby in Berkeley, University of Berkeley, they already had a small temple, and that was the president there was Dhanvir Prabhu. Dhanvir Prabhu, the same Dhanvir Maharaj who's written that book on new bhaktas. Very, very, at that time also, he was extremely enthusiastic, very sincere, but a little gullible. You know, very, he can believe people very easily, very simple devotee. So, once they had a program in the prison, penitentiary. So, Jayanand Prabhu and Keshav Prabhu, they called up the Berkeley temple and told Dhanvir Prabhu that there is a major program, you know, we are going to the prison house, the penitentiary. So, please make a lot of halwa and, you know, put lots of butter in it. That time they would put butter in the halwa. And also some sweet, Simply Wonderfuls. Simply Wonderfuls is a word which devotees coined to this wonderful sweet product. I'm not sure how it is made, but I think it's, I was told it is milk powder, but very, very sweet. So they just called it Simply Wonderfuls because everyone who tasted it would always say it's Simply Wonderful. So, so these two items were prepared in large quantities, and then they went over. Keshav Prabhu was driving, Jayanand Prabhu was there, and they took a truck, went and picked up Dhanvir Prabhu, quite a few devotees to help out, and also the and of course the prasadam. And then it was a long drive. So on the way, then Jayanand Prabhu turns to Keshav Prabhu and says that, you know, Keshav, I think it will be a good idea if the devotees get motivated, you know. So if you distribute a little prasad, they will be very motivated. What do you think? So Keshav said, "Oh yeah, it's a great idea, Jayanand. So why don't you?" So then they turn at the back and say, "Why don't you serve the prasadam, some prasad to all the devotees? Take out the plates." So they took out the plates and gave all the devotees there. Everybody had. After some time again, he says, "Oh, that was wonderful. I think maybe we should have some more, you know." So like that, they slowly, and then Dhanvir Prabhu was sitting there, you know, and then he was also participating, and then he didn't realize. And later when they were nearing the penitentiary, he just went back to the backside of the van, and then he saw that prasadam was completely over. And, you know, he was really devastated. And he was very sincere. He said, you know, he was so upset. He said, "My God, how fallen we are, you know. I mean, how can we do this? You know, we're going to the prisoners and we have finished everything. You know, this is absolutely unforgivable, you know." And he was beside himself with complete sorrow. And then they reached the penitentiary, and then the guard stops them, and he puts his head in, and he, first thing he says before the allows the van to go, and he says, "I hope there's no eatables inside because it's not allowed inside, you know." So, of course, Keshav and Jayanand Prabhu knew all along it was not allowed. Only Dhanvir Prabhu didn't know, so he had prepared everything. And then they had. Then he, when he went to New York to help out, he had one dream. It was, now this was really in the latter part of his life. His one dream was to have Srila Prabhupada, to have the Rath Yatra on Fifth Avenue. Fifth Avenue is the most important street in the world, period. It's the most famous and the most important. All the major stores, the high-class society would visit the stores. All of that would be along Fifth Avenue. Fifth Avenue is the most prestigious store. And to have Prabhupada go down that avenue was something which was really his dream. So when he went there and then he started working towards it, got the van, got devotees, got the rath, started making it, and you know, booked a parking lot nearby and got devotees engaged in it, started to prepare, and preparation started, got the permissions. And then there was one couple which was staying in the nearby building in a very high tower, and they had no connection with ISKCON, but you know, they would see for several weeks these devotees. They were, you know, on the 15th or 20th floor. From top, they could see when they were would come out in the balcony and see that how hardworking these devotees were, and they would be just observing them. So, on the maybe a week before the Rath Yatra date, that was the first sign of his illness. Actually, nobody knew. Except one devotee. Once, because Jayanand Prabhu would come very late in the night to the temple. He'd come at maybe 1, 2 in the morning, and then he'd be up at 4. So when he came in, and then Keshav Bharati Prabhu, who's now Keshav Bharati Maharaj in Vrindavan Govardhan farm, Govardhan, he actually came out of the room unexpectedly, and he saw him doubled up in pain. And he went up to him and said, "What's the matter, Jayanand?" So immediately Jayanand Prabhu's back was turned to him, so he didn't realize that there was somebody behind. So immediately straightened up and said, no, nothing's wrong. So Keshav Bharati Prabhu told him that, "See, my senses may be imperfect, but I know what I saw. So tell me what is wrong." So he said, "Okay, I'll tell you, but you promise me that don't do anything till this Rath Yatra is over. I just want Srila Prabhupada to go down Fifth Avenue." So then he told him that, then he opened up his kurta, and there were large blotches of, his body was very discolored and disfigured. Under his armpits, he had these lymph nodes which were also very disfigured. Keshav Bharati Prabhu was horrified. But since he had promised him, so he kept quiet. And then Jayanand Prabhu just carried on very working round the clock, and as usual, the last 3-4 days nobody ever saw him sleep. Nobody can. When they compared notes and talked to each other, just every time somebody or the other is engaged around, because the work was going on round the clock, getting the carts ready, and he was right in the middle of it, organizing everything. So the night before they finally put the canopy on Lord Jagannath's cart, and then as Krishna's arrangement had it, that suddenly, out of the blue, a large gust of wind came, and the whole, the central shaft, the pole, actually snapped and broke, and the canopy fell in. And at first, devotees didn't know, but this couple was watching when they were having a coffee or something at 11:30 in the night, and then they suddenly saw it. No? And they were almost in tears, because they were so... I mean, they were just watching, and they had no connection to ISKCON, but they started appreciating the such hard work they're doing. And then they saw this, and even just as any human being, they felt that, my God, this, the work is finished. So they came immediately running down, and they alerted the devotees that this has happened. And so initially they felt it is gone, but Jayanand Prabhu, I mean, that was his dream. So he just got the devotees together, and then they worked round the clock, I mean, the whole night, and got the canopy. Somehow they managed to put it up just in time, and Srila Prabhupada came the next morning. And it is very well described and spoken about by devotees. Sridhar Maharaj in particular, His Holiness Sridhar Maharaj, He has mentioned it more than one occasion that, you know, there were dozens and dozens of Rath Yatras that took place during Srila Prabhupada's physical presence here. But he says this, you know, London was a special one, but the New York Rath Yatra in 1976 was, he spoke at length about it at one of the Sunday classes. And he said that, he had also mentioned when Srila Prabhupada came, said you cannot even imagine, you can't imagine even a fraction of the ecstasy he must have felt. Because, you know, we know Srila Prabhupada's desire and heart for Rath Yatras. Right from his childhood, when he was a young boy of 4 or 5, he would organize Rath Yatra in his neighborhood and get all the children. We know that. And then to see that he's riding on the Rath down the most important, busiest street in the world, just as a glorification of Lord Jagannath and also as a contribution or as a service to his Guru Maharaj. You know, it was, and that Jayanan Prabhu had, you know, had helped him, had pleased him so much, really. So, Prabhupada came, and then that Rath Yatra was a roaring success, and everybody really were ecstatic about it. And immediately after Rath Yatra, Jayanan Prabhu disappeared. Devotees were looking, and they couldn't find him. And there, when the cleanup crew came, and then they found finally, you know, that in the canopy of Lord Jagannath, right up there, they had a small wooden plank. So he had gone up there and he, just after Rath, and he had crashed out and gone to sleep. That was typically his, because he was working for several days, and then he would rest immediately after that. And the next day, of course, because of the promise he had made, you know, he went to the doctor. He had told Kesha Bharati Prabhu, so then he phoned him from there and he said that, come over here, you know. So Kesha Bharati Prabhu said, no, you tell me what's wrong. He says, no, I'll tell you when you come here. So he dropped everything and he went running to the hospital. He met him. And then he said that the doctors are saying that he saw him. He was actually in bed with all the tubes and all in his veins. Lying there. So he said, the doctors are saying that I've got leukemia, blood cancer. I've been given, they say, maybe 6 months, maybe 2 years. They don't know, but there's no cure. He just said it very matter-of-factly. So naturally, it was a real shock to Kesha Bharati Prabhu because, you know, here he had, imagine, like, see this person beyond even the normal devotee, so physically engaged and so enthusiastic and a natural leader, just attracting devotees like a magnet being all over the place, and suddenly you see him in the bed with all the wires. So it was absolutely a real shock, you know, to Kesha Bharati Prabhu. So he, of course, he broke down and, you know, was sobbing unconsolably. After he composed himself, then he said that Jayanan Prabhu just kept quiet and just sitting there. So he said, I've got some Mahaprasad for you. So he just looked at it. So he said, my doctors have said you can't take it. He says, no. Then he suddenly got out of bed with all the tubes and the drip bag. And he said, come help me. He said, you just follow me. Let's go. He said, where are you going? He said, no, you come with me. So we'll go to the recreation room. So there's one floor below. So they just, it was quite a funny sight because first, he was walking with all the, they were holding the various bags which were attached, and with that, they just kind of ran off, went to the recreation room, and then he took out a pair of kartals from his bag, and he gave it to Kesha Bharati Prabhu. He said, now chant. So Kesha Bharati Prabhu was quite bewildered. He says, what? He says, no, you just chant. So then he started chanting, and so obviously, the kartal noise, you know, attracted many people. They were wondering what is going on in the hospital and where is this noise. So slowly, you know, patients and nurses and others started coming in. And Kesha Bharati, after some time, he stopped. But then he whispered in his ear. Jayanan Prabhu told him, now speak something. So he says, why? He said, so he got him to speak. He wanted everyone to hear. So now everybody was there, so he started speaking. And while he was speaking, Jayanan Prabhu, just see the sight, you know, he is holding his drip and then he's distributing prasad to everyone. So, as Kesha Bharati Prabhu described, he said, here he was, just got the news that he's now in months or a short time is leaving this world, and his motive is to start the first Sankirtan in the hospital. I got everybody distributing prasad, and that was the kind of caliber of this devotee. Then he got weaker and weaker. Of course, he did make efforts to take some cures. Then he had gone to Mexico. They said there was some miracle faith healer, and he tried everything, but soon he came to know that there's nothing's working. So then he came back to LA, Los Angeles, which was the kind of western headquarters of the ISKCON movement, and he wanted to start the Rath Yatra there. So, you know, the devotees in LA were saying that, look, you know, no, we don't have the funds, and also San Francisco is anyway doing it, the same state, so, you know, in California, let it, there be only one. He said, you don't worry, I'll arrange everything. So in spite of his weak health, he was phoning everybody and all his contacts and, you know, just scheduling and sweet-talking everyone, getting the money, pouring in. And devotees, I mean, people would very happily give him in kind and in cash both. So he managed that. And he was everywhere, you know, arranging and helping, again, getting some parking lot to start the work. And during the process, of course, his health became weaker and weaker, very rapidly deteriorating. Then he was in a wheelchair and was wheeled around everywhere. Even then he would be instructing, telling them how to do it, what to do. Just full of vigor, whatever he could do. And then he would go back to his room and collapse and lie on the bed. And then he would come out and carry on the work. So it was absolutely amazing. And that's why when devotees speak about him now also, they see that how he had absorbed the spirit of service and understood the mission of Srila Prabhupada to such an extent that it became, means he really demonstrated spiritual energy. Where was his energy coming from? A person whose body was deteriorating virtually daily, they could see him completely emaciated. And here he was still managing to go and tell everyone what to do, how to do it. So one day, when just some time before his departure, it was his birthday, and his parents came to see him. They also knew that now he doesn't have much time. And his parents were, because very, of course, naturally, I mean, having such a son, you know, he would be, so it was a big shock to them. And while he was talking to his parents, a devotee came and told him that, Prabhu, we have some problem on the site, so we need you there. So he immediately said, fine, you know, get somebody to wheel me. So then they wheeled him out there. And actually, they wanted to celebrate his birthday, so everybody had gathered there, and they had a big cake in the shape of a Rath Yatra, a Rath, Jagannath Rath cart. So his parents also followed. And when they came there, and he was so energized by it, Jayanand Prabhu, just the fact that he was so moved, you know, that devotees were, it was very unexpected, complete surprise. They didn't know that he was, he didn't know that they had arranged this. So here he was practically in his last stages, but he suddenly just somehow got up. And then for half an hour he spoke on the importance of having Rath Yatra and how it could benefit ISKCON and the world. For half an hour, just holding the wheelchair. And he just got that energy, was so moved, I mean, so much fired up. And which we got a glimpse of that also in His Holiness Bhakti Tirth Maharaj's departure, when he heard that entire month that he was there, where he was getting the energy from. So his parents were there, and they, of course, couldn't control themselves. They're just seeing the dedication and the strength of spiritual strength that he had. And then, of course, he just collapsed, and then they took him back in the room. And then one day, there was always devotees in his room in the last weeks. Kirtan was going on. There was always some reading of Kirtan constantly. And then stage came when he was only in bed because there was no way he could even sit up. So one day, one brahmachari, it was just a Brahma Muhurat time, and this brahmachari, before the Mangalati started in the temple, nobody told him, but he just he took Lord Jagannath's garland of the previous day, and he went nearby to next door to where Jayanand Prabhu's small apartment was, and Jayanand Prabhu was lying in bed, and this devotee was about to, there was a tape going on. So, since it was, he knew that now at 4:30 they were about to start the Mangal Aarti. So, this devotee who was there in his room, he was, so he indicated with, he could not speak, so he just indicated motion with his head that, you know, switch off the tape. So, the devotee switched off the tape because he knew that now the Mangal Aarti would start. And just when the conch shell blew, and that's the time he left this. Just see the perfect timing. See the auspiciousness of everything. The virtual second when the conch shell blew, he just, you know, his body relaxed and left. And just at that moment, the brahmachari came with the garland, and he was waiting at the at the door. So, you know, if you see from an outside, it's like the spiritual world. Everything is perfectly, it's perfectly arranged. That here, it's like a drama scene. You can't wish anything, you know, better. Somebody's, you know, wanting to go to the spiritual world, and the timing is split second perfect. The conch shell blows, this devotee comes, and he leaves. So we can actually see that in his life, his example, and through his example, the Srila Prabhupada has also given us the confidence that this process works, and also that through this all, you know, in spite of what 33 years, 32 years after his departure, there is so much hope and faith that people carry just by one person's example. And Prabhupada was so proud of him that when he heard that, he actually wrote a personal letter to Jayanand Prabhu in the present tense. Here is his disciple who has left, just like Haridas Thakur wished to leave before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's departure. So Jayanand Prabhu got the opportunity to leave before his spiritual master, and Prabhupada writes him a letter in the present tense. So the gist of it, Srila Prabhupada wrote, "My dear Jayanand Prabhu, please accept my blessings. I am today feeling very intensely the separation from you. I remember 1967 when you joined the San Francisco temple, and you were the first person who was driving the taxi and driving the car and earning. You were the first man who was contributing to the temple. You have done so many wonderful services in so many different ways. I know at the time of death, you remembered Krishna and promoted to the eternal abode of Krishna. If not, if any tinge of material desire is also there, then you've gone to the celestial kingdom with demigods for thousands of years to enjoy the material opulent life. And from there you can promote yourself to the spiritual world. But even if not that, the birth in material world is in a family of great yogis or Vaishnavas is guaranteed for the chance to revive Krishna consciousness. But as you were hearing the Krishna Kirtan, I am sure you were promoted directly. Krishna has done great favor to you so that you don't have to continue a diseased body and has given a suitable place for your service. Thank you very, very much for your wonderful services. Your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada." And then Prabhupada told the devotees that, you know, call a meeting of all devotees and discuss his wonderful qualities and distribute prasadam. And in the same letter he wrote that whenever we hold the Rath Yatras anywhere in the world, and there are hundreds of Rath Yatras now practically, I think Radha Gopinath Mandir itself has 6 or 7 at last count. Imagine, I mean, Jayanand Prabhu's photo is there on every Rath Yatra all over the world. It was a, you can say, an order or a blessing of his spiritual master. And also, why only him? So that we remember him at that time and understand that a person in that condition, just like a pujari, you know, see, his example was just like how a pujari would take care of the deities in such a perfect way, but in such a way that the focus is on the deities, not on him. He is the person serving, but the focus is never deviated from the deities. We never look at the pujari, we always are appreciating the deities. So he was the perfect example of a devotee who was in that mood, in such a way that he was serving the best way he could to his spiritual master and to the mission, but in an invisible way, with no personal gains, no motivation, just so that all the glory and attention, as rightly needed to, would go to Srila Prabhupada and the Lord Chaitanya's mission. So, Hare Krishna. Is there any questions or comments? Okay, we don't have time for that, I think. We stop at 9:30. Are there any questions? If there are any, we can take one or two of these.
Hare Krishna. So you mentioned the first part of the class when we get pulled by both the sides when we are initially neophytes. So especially with we get impressed by these so-called people with qualities and opulence. Or so how to deal with donors or celebrities or dignitaries who may be useful for our movement?
In the same way, we genuinely appreciate, I mean, we admire how Krishna's mysterious ways work and how he brings the, how he distributes his, you know, there's so many attributes. Everybody has some attribute or the other in different, up to different levels. So, if we stay connected to the movement and if we are constantly hearing and following the process, then momentarily we may even get carried away. But then at some time we will reflect and see that actually, you know, ultimately this is not the that my role model. Not that we would dedicate our life to be only like this. Today what happens is that in the absence of any spiritual knowledge, we would people would want to become like a particular, you know, sportsman or a film star or some politician or some businessman who's really made a big impact. So that because that is the nature of the person to really, you know, especially in India, the tendency to hero worship is so much there. So it happens. So it is really a question of if we have the understanding and we listen attentively, we see that even though these are admirable attributes, but it is so tiny compared to, I mean, what can even the greatest of the great personalities can't even control their yawn. If they want to yawn, they can't stop it. What to speak of death? They can't, you know, they're totally helpless. We're just almost like a puppet. So we have such tiny abilities. We can't even, you know, we can't do so many things. So, if not at that time, when we do hear and reflect, we would be able to see that. So, it is important, especially when we are associating more and more with the material world, for Grihasthas in particular, and especially those who are likely to be associating more with, you know, materialistic or monetary gains, that we have to be even more careful. So we anticipate that, and we have to be taking that much more precautions to see that we don't get sucked away. And devotees would do that. Here you are given a warning, you already know that, and we can sense it also. We can see a wavering if you, when you travel abroad or meet outside, if you are away for some extended period of time, when we are not in our normal spiritual comfort zone, we can see the complacency coming in, you know, we get more attracted. So we have to pull ourselves up. So it is like a pull and pull, but at least for a devotee, having the mental understanding already and some realizations also, you know, the opportunity is there to, then it's up to us how much we take the precautions. It's not unexpected or it's not completely out of the blue. But also actually when we do have certain kind of appreciation, means not appreciation I would say, but at least a recognition of the strength of some people, etc. I mean we can, it helps us to actually genuinely express it without any envy. When we can say, you know, person, you know, he's a very analytical mind or some excellent skills, we can see that also. But then we immediately see who's behind it, no? Yeah.
Thank you very much, Prabhu, for your nice class. It's appropriate that, you know, you should be speaking about Jayanand Prabhu, who's done for so many devotees, you know, reached out. Just a question that comes to my mind, Prabhu, that we see from the life of Jayanand Prabhu and also so many other devotees, like Mother Ladini and Kunti Mataji and so many, you know, of Prabhupada disciples who left their bodies in so much of intense suffering, in one sense, in a on a physical level. So the fear always comes to our mind that, you know, in order to be really be able to go home back to Godhead, does one really have to go through such intense suffering? You know, is it absolutely necessary? You know, so that was a doubt that...
I don't think anyone in this room will be able to answer that, because that is in Krishna's prerogative how he would like to take us. So, but one thing is also clear, that death means pain. That the moment of death is equal to more than 42,000 scorpion stings. So we can't even begin to imagine what it may be like. So that is true. But at the same time, why only Prabhupada disciples? We've had so many examples in front of our own eyes. Abhiram Gopal Thakur Prabhu, Stoga Krishna Prabhu. Very recent times, recent years, you know, the last few years, where we've seen at different ages and backgrounds, that actually, though it is painful at one level, but then somehow the spiritual purity, at least to our eyes, I mean, it seems that, you know, that they're not feeling the pain, or they're able to transcend it with the help of Guru and Gauranga. So we just follow the process, and then we also understand and hear that Krishna will take care. So, but avoiding pain, physical pain, is that is synonymous with death. Death means pain, but the devotee, like even in Parikshit Maharaj, I mean, he, when the Tataksha bird was to come, you know, he just let it come. But then by that time he had reached such a understanding also, so it didn't matter really. I don't know, then Gopal would like to comment on the So, Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.